We're pleased today to bring you a podcast on an interesting and controversial topic that's hitting the news right now in sports medicine. We would warn you that if you are not excited about speaking about sports in the context of sexual identity, then we would suggest that you turn this podcast off and not listen to it. You should be aware there are no explicit sexual references made, but just the concept of gay, lesbian, and transgendered athletes are talked about quite extensively. And while we present this in a non-judgmental way, if you have strong opinions and you'd prefer not to listen to this podcast, we welcome you to turn it off and be with us next week.
Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in a language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Well, hello and welcome to the weekly edition of the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance podcast. I'm your host, Tim Lightfoot, and we're so glad that you took the time to join us. You've downloaded us and you're listening, and every week we bring you interesting people in the world of sports medicine, human performance, and in general health as it relates to exercise. And this week, of course, is no exception. We have Dr. George Cunningham with us today. Welcome to the podcast, George.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, well, we're glad to have you. It's been a long time coming, but we got you here eventually. Let me tell the audience a little bit about Dr. Cunningham and why we're so pleased to have him with us here. Dr. Cunningham has a PhD in sport and exercise management from Ohio State University. He actually has a master's degree from Texas A&M, so he's one of the home guys. He's come back. He is currently associate dean for graduate studies in the College of Education and Human Development here at Texas A&M. He is a professor in our division of sports management. He's the director of the Laboratory for Diversity in Sport, and he's received a variety of external funding over the years. He's published over 100 journal articles and book chapters. He has written an award-winning textbook called Diversity in Sport Organizations. And if you knew how young he really was, it makes us all feel like slackers. Thanks, George, for that.
My pleasure.
You really helped my self-esteem today quite a bit. He's got a variety of other honors. He's the editor of a couple of different journals. And just an all-around great scholar. And we're glad to have him. And Dr. Cunningham also was recently named the Young Alumni of the Year for Ohio State University. Congratulations on that award.
Thank you.
Big award.
Thank
yeah.
you.
So we've asked Dr. Cunningham here to talk to us today about his research, since he runs a laboratory for diversity of sports. In particular, recently he's been looking more and more at issues that are faced by lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered athletes. So how did you get into this area?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we look at diversity in general, and so I've looked at issues related to race and gender, ability, physical or mental ability, weight discrimination, and a lot of it is, when I go to different areas, is based on student interest as well. And so I had a student, actually two students, who were interested in LGBT issues, and so it started probably, I guess, 5 or 6 years ago with one of those students who actually just published a book on that topic. And I contributed a chapter, but I was very pleased that, as the proud advisor, that that she published a book in that area.
Our students are very much like our family. And
yes,
when they succeed, we're excited for them.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah.
Relative to other areas in diversity, it's underexplored. And so because of that and the very real effects that that sort of prejudice and discrimination has, we had a keen interest in that area.
Yeah. Talk to us a little bit about that. And this is a topic that I think many people would prefer not to talk about.
Yep.
But I think it exists. Matter of fact, there was, a study that showed that in the last year, 87% of transgendered individuals had been threatened. 53% had been pushed or shoved, 26% had been punched, kicked, or injured, and 46% reported having missed school. So there's obviously some physical ramifications.
Yeah, and you see that though with transgender, for example, you see that among a broad band of individuals. So it's not just people in one area of the country or participating in one activity, but the stats you mentioned, you see a lot of transgender individuals in schools experiencing physical danger. They are likely to hear negative comments, and it's not just from their classmates. It's from teachers. It's from administrators. And not that I can excuse classmates, but I think I said silly things when I was in junior high or high school.
Right. Peers are pretty tough on folks.
Yes. Yeah. It doesn't excuse that, but, you know, when you hear or when you see the data that it's coaches and teachers and administrators, I think that's where it's probably, I think, more surprising, more hurtful, because those are people responsible in large part for creating inclusive and safe environments, and they really set the tone. So when you don't have that, then you really see a lot of the damage come about.
So let's, I guess, maybe back up a step, and let's put some operational definitions around some of these terms. Some of our listeners may not be familiar with it. How do you define transgender?
So I'm going to not directly answer that, but
okay. We
usually use the word trans,
okay,
because that would be a very inclusive term for transgender people who have maybe identify from their gender identity in ways that don't necessarily match your biological sex. Okay. People who have gone through surgery or those who have not. So all of those would have specific terms, but trans really encompasses that. So I think we could probably think of it as one's gender identity or expression not really matching their biological sex.
Okay.
And as one scholar noted, it's people really like to put others in categories. Mm-hmm. We like to classify things. Nature does not.
Mm-hmm.
And so oftentimes you just don't have that match, and that's the way nature made you. So,
yeah, there's one of the things as you read about this, and one of the links we'll put up on our website is to an article you and I have chatted about, and we're going to chat about a little bit more, that was in Sports Illustrated this past May about the transgendered athletes and some of the issues that they face. And some of the folks that came out actually in the article and talked about their own journeys, the word courageous sometimes is often used, but they do face an uphill battle in society nowadays.
Yeah.
You know, one of the questions that we had is does keeping that kind of sexual orientation under wraps, is that harmful to people, do you think, or stressful as they try to compete as an athlete or otherwise in life?
Yeah, so if you think about just in your daily life, if you hold on to something that you can't tell everybody else, that kind of, at least it weighs on me. If I have a big secret and I can't tell others, then I think about it. It takes me away from being able to concentrate on my writing or other activities. So, you know, that secret may be about whatever at school or in life. But if we amplify that and think about our sexual orientation, where a really key part of who we are as a person, or our gender identity and expression, another key part of who we are. And if we have to hold on to that where we think we can't tell others, we can't tell our friends, we can't tell our family, you know, I mean, I think it weighs on you.
Mm-hmm.
And it weighs on you, and you start to think about how others would respond.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes those are not congruent. You can look at outsports.com, which is a website devoted to LGBT issues, and they have a lot of evidence showing that when people actually do disclose their sexual orientation or gender identity, that the responses are very positive.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, unless you've done that, I think oftentimes you fear the worst. It's a very scary thing, and you don't know if you're going to get outcast or beat up or discriminated against.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of negative that could come about. So it's understandable, the anxiety and stress that comes about from holding on to that.
Yeah. There were a couple, I think, recent pretty high-profile soccer players in particular. I know this past week, Robbie Rogers played MLS, played in the English Premier League on the national team. He came out and said he was gay and that he was, as a result of that, and holding in, he probably was going to step away from soccer.
Mm-hmm.
I know Megan Rapinoe, who's on the women's national team as well, has come out as gay. And I think overall they've been fairly supported.
They have. You know, the big difference between Robbie and Megan is Megan's still playing.
Yeah.
And Robbie didn't feel like he could continue.
Right.
Some people saw that overall scenario as an advancement because you had very high-profile players and teams come out and say, it's okay, we'd welcome you back on the team, et cetera. And those are certainly very positive steps.
Right.
And I understand that. I still think that we have quite a ways to go, that he was 25, still quite skilled, mm-hmm. and felt like he couldn't have those two identities, one as a soccer player and one as a gay man,
mm-hmm.
Be compatible. Mm-hmm. So feel the need to step away from soccer shows that we still have quite a ways to go on the men's side.
Yeah,
I mean, there's no active professional athletes in the U.S., so the big four, hockey, football, baseball,
basketball.
There we go.
One of those big four.
Yeah, who have come out and identify as gay or bisexual mm-hmm. while they're playing.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them do after, but not while they're playing.
Right.
So I think that suggests a whole lot, that it may not be a welcome environment. You see that during Super Bowl week. Some of the players indicated that they wouldn't accept a gay teammate and they're on their team and their locker room. And others provided a counter narrative to that. But it's, I mean, that's a real thing that's happening. Yeah. So,
well, you're talking about some of the real ramifications. Of course, the first thing I go to is, what do you do about locker rooms?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I don't know. There's not a lot of evidence when people come out at the high school level, college level. In fact, I'm not aware of any evidence mm-hmm. to suggest that it's a locker room issue in mm-hmm. terms of people making passes or advances one another. Again, those are things that we probably think about as worst-case scenarios, but the actual empirical or anecdotal evidence doesn't support. So it just, I think those are non-issues.
Yeah. I think doesn't the NCAA basically say it's whatever the athlete feels comfortable with?
Yeah, so there's a lot of policies. Erin Basuvas has done a lot of work. She's a lawyer mm-hmm. and a professor at Western New England College, and talked about from least inclusive to most inclusive policies. So the IOC for a long time didn't have any policy,
right. mm.
and then had what she describes as the least inclusive. So for a player or an athlete to participate in the Olympics, they have to have undergone sex reassignment surgery, had hormone treatment for at least 2 years, and received legal recognition of their transition sex in order to participate. Mm. That's a whole lot
mm-hmm.
to take place. And if you think about the short shelf life of an athlete to participate at that high level, mm-hmm. to go through at least 2 years, and that's not necessarily during the training either,
right.
that's a lot to do. So the NCAA is a little bit more inclusive, but still not most inclusive, in that you have to have gone through hormone treatment.
Mm.
And so if you're a male and your expression is such of a woman, then you have to have undergone at least a year of hormone treatment to participate.
And that's testosterone suppression in that case.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you think about, again, you have 4 years, you could have a medical red shirt that mm-hmm. that could count, but that's still quite expensive as well. It requires people to go through things that will impact their body later on in life as well. And so there's really other systems in place, such as in Washington or in Massachusetts, where it's simply how you identify, how do you express yourself in terms of your gender identity. And if you can demonstrate that that's a sincere expression, so everybody account or who testifies, let's say, says, yes, George identifies that way, or Sarah identifies that way, whoever, then you can participate. So it doesn't matter your sex on your birth certificate. You don't have to go through treatments. You don't have to go through different reassignment surgeries. That's really the most inclusive way to do things. And, you know, people have concerns about competitive advantage and things like
that.
There'd
be a bit of a physiological advantage if someone with biological male sex was allowed to compete against females.
Yeah.
Just testosterone leads to body mass. And I mean, there are examples where there have been some documented cases of where you go on testosterone suppression and your running times come down, a variety of physiological things happen mm-hmm. that really make the genders equal.
But that's really, I mean, I understand that at the very elite level.
Mm.
I think most people don't participate at the very elite level. Mm.
So you're just talking about almost recreational or up to high school? Or?
I think through high school.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's a system in place. I mean, my daughter is 7 years old, is in a soccer league now. They're already segregated, boys soccer and girls soccer. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, especially when you look at the bodies and abilities of 7-year-old boys and girls.
Right.
But, you know, I mentioned that because from a very young age, we segregate based on biological sex.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we think about other ways of thinking about how we would participate in sport, whether it's on high school teams, rec league, whatever, it's just different than how we've done it. It doesn't mean that it's wrong. It doesn't mean that there's advantages or disadvantages to other people. And again, you know, we're not talking about the top 1% athlete or even beyond that, mm-hmm. the very elite athlete. I mean, most people don't really participate at that level.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if we took a step back and really thought about what's the purpose of this, what's the purpose of sport participation, what are the benefits of it, and the outcomes of denying people that participation opportunity, we may think about things differently.
Sure.
But
I don't want to belabor the point, but if I had a daughter, let's say it was playing basketball mm-hmm. in high school, and there was an individual who had been born as a male and wanted to play basketball with the females, I think I'd have concerns about that. Maybe they're not at the elite level, but still there's a competition involved.
Mm-hmm.
You still want to be able to play on a level playing field, so to speak. So isn't that still unfair if we don't ask people who want to, that may be trans, do something that will equalize them physiologically?
So you would be in favor of having that player
mm-hmm.
go through a year of hormone treatment before she is 18 years old?
Well, I don't know that I will come out and say that I'm for it or not. I'm just setting up.
It raises a question.
I'm just raising the question about competitive fairness, because there is the underlying thought that, and we can talk about fairness all day long, but there is a thought about that there is, by segregation, especially after puberty, that there is some level playing field to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't see a female who was a trans who was born female wanting to participate in male sports. I mean, they might, but they would be at a huge physiological disadvantage.
Yeah, so that's, I think there's a lot to weigh there.
Yeah.
I think
we have a lot to unpack here, Georgia.
Yeah, so I appreciate your comments about competitive fairness. I would probably...
Very nice way of saying you disagree.
No, I would just think about, one, how frequently is somebody going to have that... Let's say we adopt the Washington standard for high schools,
okay.
where you have that sincere gender identity expression.
Sure.
So that's going to be relatively rare.
Mm.
And so... But if that's the case, and let's say somebody born... biologically a male, identifies as a female, and wants to participate, I would say that the benefits of allowing that person to participate for the individual and for ideas of inclusiveness would outweigh potential physiological differences and potential competitive advantage differences. Now,
so you need to know you're going to get a lot of pushback on that, don't you?
That's fine. I get pushback all the time.
Well, let me ask you, but you know, you raise a point that we haven't talked about, and that's prevalence. What is the prevalence of this in society?
So if we think about people who identify as lesbian, gay, or bisexual, it's wide range. I think the probably best number is about 11%.
Okay.
And so how you measure that, how you... how people identify, you know, that's going to be quite varied, right, but generally 11%. The number of transgender individuals is obviously quite a bit lower. Mm-hmm. And one of the figures that I saw was 700,000 in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And so if we think of 700,000 out of, what, 350 million or
something
so,
like that, yeah, that's a... It's growing all the time.
Very, very, very small percent.
Yeah.
And that's from people, you know, age 7 through 97. So.
So you're saying the probability of these things happen may be pretty low.
Pretty low.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So we're talking about possibilities and possible ramifications, but probability may be low.
Okay. Yes.
And as scientists and as academics, that's what we weigh all the time, right? Possibilities,
sure,
versus probabilities.
Sure.
Right.
And
so,
it's good discussions to have about, I mean, the SI article brought up a ton of those points.
Yeah.
And what's fair, it, you know, some of the athletes mentioned in there were at the Division III level. So I would think that Division III is more a participatory model than Division I. But even at that level, there are issues. I mean, I understand those concerns.
Yeah.
And, but I think that, again, those need to be weighed against the other benefits of that, the benefits for that individual competing, the benefits for her teammates and seeing that inclusive environment. For the athletic department or university as a whole. I've done research at one of those universities mentioned in the SI article, and you see a lot of broader benefits beyond just to the individual athlete.
Yeah.
So what we do for the individual directly impacts everybody else indirectly.
Mm-hmm. So one of the issues that's brought up is sex verification testing. I mean, there's the world record holder in the 800 meters for the females, a caster, I can't think of her last
name.
Yeah, out of South Africa, has been caught up in this over the last 2 or 3 years. Do you think that's a violation of people's privacy, the sex verification testing? I mean, I can think off the top of my head about 6 female athletes that you go, are they really female?
I think that sex verification testing, a couple of things. One says a lot about what we think a male and a female should be, and who should be considered a male or a female. And again, I go back to, while we as scientists or as people in society like to place things in neat little categories, mm-hmm, nature does not.
Mm-hmm.
And so the South African runner was able to keep all her awards, and yet had to go through a fairly invasive, very public testing that we don't necessarily put on others.
Mm-hmm.
And so if somebody has XYX chromosomes,
which they have no choice in.
Correct.
We should put that right up front. That's something they have no choice in.
Correct.
Yeah.
In fact, that's the dad and his contribution, or the biological father's contributions.
Yeah.
I don't know that the benefits outweigh the very real cost,
right,
for that athlete.
Right.
There are others, some college athletes now, who people discuss, oh, I'd love to do, or I wonder what the gender test on that, sex verification test for that person would be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because some of those athletes don't look like what we think maybe female athletes should look like.
Mm-hmm.
I would suspect, again, that it's not just those athletes that have maybe different chromosomes. It's a whole lot.
Well, we really subtly shifted the topic from a societal-based concept of gender to the biological, because these sex verification tests are biological in nature.
Yes.
They're about biologically what we're supposed to have as males and females, supposedly. And but in so much of what has been written about and what you've written about, it's about a societal definition of what someone believes they are and feels like they should be.
Yes, and that's I think that's an excellent point. The should be could be in air quotes, which really doesn't transfer over on a podcast.
That's right. Yeah. Just imagine we're all doing air quotes on our hand. That's right.
But I think that's a good point. It's classifications that we've developed.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you think about the South African runner, she lived her whole life as a woman,
mm-hmm,
never thought otherwise. According to at least Sports Illustrated articles, other articles written about her. So
with no issues until she started issues at all. Blitzing the world records.
Yes.
So then everybody went, what is going on here?
Yeah.
Well, George, it's been a great time. We're running out of time, unfortunately, today. And as we do with all of our guests, I'd like to give you an opportunity to give us a take-home message.
Take-home message. I think the take-home message is that we, as sport administrators, as instructors in classes, as people who run sport leagues, can make a difference. Just because we haven't done things traditionally doesn't mean that we shouldn't think about redoing those. And again, I'm a big believer that an inclusive policy or an inclusive action toward one individual certainly benefits that individual. But there's just a mountain of evidence showing that impacts others indirectly as well. And so I would be hard-pressed to find a time when inclusive policies or procedures have really a negative outcome. And unfortunately, we don't see there's very few sport leagues, sport organizations that have these really inclusive policies. But the more we have, the more benefits we can see of being active in sport or exercise or different forms of physical activity.
Yeah, and people, sport leagues usually aren't proactive on this stuff.
No, they're not.
It's usually after something happens.
Yes.
Yeah, unfortunately. Well, great take-home message. Thanks.
All right, thank you.
And thank you so much for being here with us today.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity.
Okay. You're more than welcome. And we'll bring you back sometime. Going to be a fun podcast. For all you that are listening, I know you have been waiting. It's been a month or so since you've heard had a podcast t-shirt question. And so we have our producer, Cheryl, here with us today with the podcast question of the day.
According to the NCAA, how many years of hormone therapy treatment does a transgender athlete have to go through until they can participate in sport competition?
Be the first one to send us the correct answer to that question, and you will win one of those nifty podcast t-shirts. So we look forward to seeing those answers flood our email boxes. You can send it to huffeinspodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. Again, thank you for being with us today, George. Enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you. I look forward to hearing it.
Yeah. And again, thank you, all of you that are listening, for taking the time to download us. To take the time to listen and take the time to comment on our website. You'll also see we've got a new website up as well, so you'll enjoy looking at that as well. So until next week, when we have another interesting individual from the world of sports medicine and human performance, we hope that you have an active and healthy week.
Thanks for listening to the Huffines Institute Weekly Sports Medicine Podcast. This podcast was produced by Cheryl Marek and Kelly Selman and made possible by generous support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. This podcast is published under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. That means you can't sell it or change it, but feel free to give it to everyone you know and to talk and blog about us. And in case you were wondering, our openings and closing are provided by johnmilesproductions.com, and our music was provided by Dave Zeltner. Find him on the web at davidzeltner.com. And just so you know, we love hearing from you. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffeinspodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.